Welcome to Theatre Voice at the Duke of York's Theatre in London. My name is Heather Neal and I'm with playwright David Eldridge, whose Under the Blue Sky, first seen at the Royal Court in 2000, is being revived here, directed by Anna McMinn, and with a terrific cast including Francesca Annis and Catherine Tate. Under the Blue Sky is made up of three separate interrelated plays, in each of which two teachers discuss and discover things about their relationships. The play opens with an explosion, an IRA bomb, heard by Helen and Nick. Helen loves Nick, but he's about to leave both her and the state school where they both teach in Leytonstone. In the middle section, Michelle, played by Catherine Tate, tries to get her revenge on Nick, now a colleague at a public school in Essex, who has just dumped her by sleeping with the staff nerd, Graham. Then in the last play, Anne, played by Francesca Annis, and Robert, once colleagues and still teachers, discover their love for each other, despite a 16-year age gap, and incidentally fill in for us the fates of some of the other characters. Well, teachers, it's well known, I think, David, that you started at a state school and then you got a scholarship to a fee-paying school, and you seem to have observed your teachers very carefully. What did you think about your teachers at the time you were at school, or is this something that's been lurking in your mind for a long time?
Well, I mean, I had the sort of normal sort of mixed bag of reactions and emotions about the teachers that I had at school, some of whom I liked, some of whom I didn't like, some of whom I thought were really good classroom teachers and some of whom I thought were mediocre. But I mean, really, the play comes out of getting to know teachers since I left school, actually. After I left school and did my A-levels and went to university, I stayed in touch with my former drama teacher, and we subsequently, over the years, became quite good friends. And really, sort of via the sort of friendship with her, I sort of got an entree into a sort of world, really, that I wouldn't necessarily have had access to. I mean, I suppose, you know, if that friendship hadn't become a sort of important part of my life, then, you know, teachers would have remained people that just stood in front of the black or whiteboard. But in fact, I sort of got a glimpse sort of into, you know, their private lives, really. You know, I mean, there's an argument for saying, you know, that in a way, Under the Blue Sky comes out of hearing teachers gossip about one another over sort of several sort of years, actually.
The title Under the Blue Sky, does that come from Chekhov?
Well, it's partly a bit inspired by sort of Irina, actually, in The Three Sisters. Yeah. And because she sort of talks about kind of the blue sky. And it's at the beginning of the play. We sort of know that her fate, actually, by the end, is she's going to become a teacher. She's not going to kind of go and do any of the sort of romantic sort of things like marry a soldier or anything like that. But it partly comes out of that. The other thing is that the play ends on a moment of possibility. And when I thought about it, when I tried to think of a kind of a visual and theatrical image, I couldn't think of anything better than a completely cloudless blue sky. Mm. So that's kind of where the title comes from.
Right. So, teachers. The play isn't only about teachers, though, is it? They sort of stand for more than that here, although obviously you want the characters to be real to us. You're saying other things as well about public service, aren't you?
Well, yeah, I am. I mean, the first thing is, I mean, I've always sort of been fascinated in fiction by the subject of unrequited love. I don't know why. I don't know whether it's a sort of a yearning in me, certainly when I was in my 20s, or just a part of my taste and interest in kind of art and literature. But one of my favourite novels is Kazuo Ishiguro's The Remains of the Day. And I've always been particularly sort of touched by stories of unrequited love.
And you've described teaching as that, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's kind of what I was coming to, really, which is that there's a part of me that sort of thinks there's a bit of teaching which is actually sort of has got an element of unrequited love in it. There's a kind of a generosity of spirit and giving which is never, ever really quite reciprocated. And if a teacher is of kind of a generous and noble spirit, then that's something that doesn't matter. You know, the poorer teachers are the people that tend to resent that finally and become a bit embittered and either kind of stay at a school for years and years and sort of waste away or just get out of teaching. I did very much want to kind of meditate on the sort of nature of unrequited love with three couples in different relationships and at different stages of their life. And the other thing I was really interested in was, and sort of taking one step forwards again from sort of, you go unrequited love into teaching and then on from that, is the idea really of public service, really. When the play was written, it was written in 1999, just before the beginning of the millennium. And there were kind of two things that were in the ether that I was really responding to, that were bubbling away for me. The first, really, was the sense of the kind of end of the millennium and looking back, you know, looking back over this sort of incredibly violent century in human history, a century that had sort of been sort of marked by two very hot wars and one cold one. And out of that, finding ourselves on the edge of the new millennium, and actually kind of a moment of kind of possibility, maybe historically, the Berlin Wall had come down. You've got Clinton in the White House. Francis Fukuyama is writing a book called, you know, The End of History, and saying that history has ended, liberal democracy has won, all of that sort of stuff. I sort of was looking back kind of over that history. I'm very interested in history. If I didn't do an English and drama degree, you're certain I'd have done a history degree. And I sort of was very interested in sort of, especially when I was looking back to the First World War, how, you know, there was a real sense of nobility and duty, and people really were different then. I felt it was their duty, and that sort of tied in with ideas of teaching and public service. And the other thing was that out of the Blair Clinton energy of the 90s, there was this curious thing which is now sort of being widely dismissed, probably rightly actually, of the third way, of kind of somehow negotiating, you know, the kind of ideological struggles that had grown out of the 20th century. You know, and the difference between public and private, you know, and it wasn't just a sort of abstract concept, that, because people, you know, were feeling comfortable about being more kind of ambiguous about political views, or people that once worked in the public sectors were working in the private sector and vice versa, you know, the Labour Party becoming full of kind of more business interests and management consultants, and the Conservative Party after the harsh Thatcher years, you know, a kind of a more kind of outward sort of soul searching within their own collapse. So there was sort of lots of stuff that was going on. So it felt like a really good time to write a play about teachers, you know, people that are at the edge, cutting edge of that, those debates in a way, you know. And if you've got a teacher that kind of follows another teacher out of a state school, which she's got principled attachment to, and then goes to a private school, but for reasons of love, that kind of felt like a very, you know, that felt like a very kind of pertinent kind of late 90s theme anyway.
Mm. Well, you started very early, didn't you? I think you were only 22 when you had your first play put on, is that right? But you wrote it actually at Exeter University, didn't you?
Yeah, I wrote my first play when I was sort of just doing my second year, my part one exams at the end of my second year. So it was just before I turned 21.
And that was Serving It Up?
Yeah.
Which was immediately put on?
Yeah, well, I kind of wrote it that summer, and then I rewrote it a bit in my final year, and then I sent it out while I was doing my finals, and sort of, you know, I didn't think anything would come of it, in all honesty. But one by one, all these theatres got back in touch with me, Hampstead Theatre and the National and Stratford East and the Bush, all saying that they really liked the play. And then, to my sort of amazement, the Bush said that they really loved the play and they were thinking of producing it.
And then they commissioned Under the Blue Sky, didn't they, the Bush?
Yeah.
And you were only 25, going on 26, when you wrote that. but then they didn't put it on. Did you have to wrestle with this play rather more than others? I think you said the structure was quite difficult to come by.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of couple of few stages to it, really. I mean, basically, when Serving It Up was on at the Bush, it was a real success, and the theatre really sort of generously commissioned another play from me. And you know, I'm not a writer that tends to kind of bang them out in 6 months. I tend to take a real lot of time over it, and normally a play is a process over sort of 2 or 3 years for me.
Do you mean it's going on in the back of your mind and the writing is
both,
quite quick?
Actually. A lot of thinking, a lot of writing in bursts, fits and starts, revisiting.
So you're not a sort of 9-to-5 writer?
No, I am actually. I am. I get to my desk at 9 in the morning pretty much and leave it at 6 pretty much. But there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of rumination. And and I think what happened with The Bush was I just, you know, that it took me 3 years to write it. And in that time, I really changed. You know, I'd really changed. You know, I was kind of 5 years older than the person that had written Serving It Up. I'd sort of different interests. I'd different area of kind of interest in sort of writing a more kind of, I suppose, some of the more middle-class experiences that I'd come across that interested me, rather than the kind of urban working class experiences. And also with Under the Blue Sky, it was the first time I really experimented with form. You know, I'd kind of tended to write fairly elegantly structured social realist plays that have sort of lower middle class, urban class characters and stories. And then suddenly this play comes in, which has kind of got this kind of, you know, unexpected triptych type structure, you know, and the characters don't reappear, and the sexual tension is kind of not detonated in the scene, but it's sort of detonated in the following scene, and also the characters are middle class, and I just think, you know, in all fairness to them, you know, it just wasn't the play that they were expecting at all, and they had their view on it, and you know, they very quickly released the play for me to take it elsewhere, and fortunately the Royal Court loved the play and thought it was my best play, and it got on. So, you know,
But I think you've said it's the one you're most fond of, is that right? Or proudest of? Or is perhaps that's changed because you keep writing, so there's going to be another one.
I don't think it's the play that I'm most proud of. I think it's in general, I get the impression that it's the play of mine that people within the theatre world are most fond of mine. I mean, you know, play it's a bit of an obvious analogy, but nevertheless it's a true one, that, you know, the plays are a bit like the children in the fact, and there are no favourites. There are different things about plays that you really like about them, you know, or don't like about them yourself, you know, and that's, you know, that's true of Under the Blue Sky, or bits about them that intrigue you or that you didn't expect. But no, I think partly it's because the play ends on a note of redemption and possibility. I think that people find unusual, you know, that there tend to be a lot of kind of bleak, ambiguous endings, and I didn't write that. And I think people warm to that. Someone told me that when it was done at the Royal Court, it was their first hopeful ending for 15 years. So,
well done, I'd say. Well, at the turn of the millennium, we really needed that, didn't we? Hasn't gone quite right since. But,
well, no. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, if you think about the sort of, you know, the metaphorical life of play and the life of the play and the imagery of the play, I mean, I was slightly circumspect myself about this proclamation from Francis Fukuyama and others that history had ended, you know, and that's why, quite deliberately, actually, the play begins with someone saying the ceasefire is over, and actually it ends with the last post rather than vice versa.
And now, of course, when we hear a bomb at the beginning, we think, we know what that is. If you don't know the play, it's not the IRA you're going to think of.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's been one of the very fascinating things about being involved in this revival, you know, which I'm absolutely over the moon with, actually. I think it's had a super, super revival. And I think it's excellent that Sonia Friedman, you know, is prepared to...
That's the producer, yes.
Yeah, a contemporary play like this in the West End. But
in the summer too, it's very, very daring, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is, I suppose, and it isn't. But, I mean, to an extent, you know, opening plays in the West End and presenting plays commercially, you're sort of... You're always kind of guided a bit by when your acting talent's available. And, you know, this was a good time for Catherine to do a play. And with the school summer holidays and all of that, yes. It did feel like a...
Lots of teachers available to come and see it.
Yeah, you can never rely on the British summer, can you? So, I personally wasn't too worried about that. But to come back to just where we were before, I mean, it's been really fascinating sort of seeing the sort of imagery and resonance of the play come alive in a slightly different way, because, as you said, history didn't end in the 90s, as Fukuyama proclaimed at the time. And in fact, almost a year to the day after this play opened at the Royal Court in 2000, on September the 11th, 2001, history very much said that it was...
Took a
in
great
full
lurch.
Flow.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the kind of I mean, I think that the imagery, the military imagery in the play, and the, you know, the kind of the, I suppose the way that kind of there's a re, you know, the way that that military imagery is sort of is explored in the context of the redefinition of men's roles and masculinity. You know, it's all set at a time when men no longer expect to be soldiers or women to nurse them, in fact. You know, actually, when you see it in 2008 and you hear that last post, what it makes me think about is seeing, you know, Union Jack draped coffins being unloaded at Bryce Norton. So actually, you know, it's the plays being revisited at a time at which actually our boys are being sent overseas to fight and sometimes die in our name. And the last post is being sounded when we bury them, and it's a quite shocking and disturbing resonance for me, actually. So it's very fascinating, that element of it.
Well, the structure is very daring, actually, isn't it? Because the plays look almost separate, although they're not, of course, and it's only gradually that we realise how they're connected. But they are rather different in style and feel as well, aren't they? There's sort of the middle one is almost farcical, and the last one is elegiac and romantic. And so you move not only from one couple to another couple to another couple, but from one style to another, and to some extent. Was that something you particularly wanted to do?
Yeah, a little bit, actually. I mean, I think that there are kind of different energies that really sort of inform kind of where the play comes from. I mean, obviously, I talked about, you know, just the fact that I knew teachers and was very interested in writing about the teachers. I hadn't really seen the people that I knew on stage or screen before, you know, certainly at that point. I mean, I think the first thing I was really interested in was that actually... You know, one of the things that's really nice if you get together with teachers is that they, within half an hour of, sort of someone opening a bottle of wine and people nattering and colleagues from another school that have been brought along, you know, sort of start meeting someone else, they all sort of discover connections with each other. And so it was really, I was really keen to find a form for the play that really expressed that, was really expressive of those connections. And also those geographical journeys, you know. You know, the play is kind of East End, Essex, Devon, which is sort of my own family and my geographical journey a bit, which I was keen to write. And certainly in terms of the tone in each scene, I think I was interested to find a different tone in each scene, but insofar as it comes out of the truth of the characters, you know, because the three situations that the three relationships find themselves in are really, really different, you know, and a hungover August Sunday morning is very, very different to a sort of a riotous drunken shag gone wrong, you know, at one, to a sort of uptight, tonight's the night I get laid, first drink of the evening. So,
well, you mentioned drink a number of times. There's quite a lot of alcohol in it, isn't there?
Well, yeah, there is.
But
is,
wasn't that part of your original scheme for the play?
Yeah, I mean, originally the play started out as one two-hander, and it was I mean, it's ended up actually in a triptych type form, you know. I mean, you know, got a lot of courage really from Robert Holman's play Making Noise Quietly and Wallace Shawn's play A Thought in Three Parts. It's a sort of a lovely notion of a play, that, A Thought in Three Parts. But originally it was sort of just one couple, and it was intended to be much more like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And that has a really lovely sort of, you know, there's the first drunkenness kind of bleached out sort of aftermath effect to that. And I thought that that was a lovely kind of conceit, you know, the first drink, the drunkenness and the hangover. But finally, you know, I realised that just one couple didn't really, really convey that kind of connectedness and sense of connection and sense of actually fun and gossip, actually, that I knew
about. And the
about
community.
Yeah, absolutely, the community, you know, and the sense of community in particular in state school staff rooms. Yeah. And the slight sense of cliques and competition in private school staff rooms. And so actually I realised that you could have that same form, in a way, of a threat structure with first drink, drunkenness and hangover, but actually that it need not be one couple, it could be three. Mm. Sadly, the original couple aren't in this play. They're at the bottom of a drawer somewhere, but I'm thankful for them because they helped me along on the journey towards where it is now. Yeah.
That's great. Well, you've done a lot of other things besides this play. We've talked about it mainly, but you were most famous, perhaps, after the first play and this one for Feston, which you did an adaptation of, which you did for the Almeida, and Market Boy, which was an extraordinary explosion onto the Olivier stage, and that went back to your roots, as it were, as well, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, I had a very, very, I mean, in a way, I had a very, very sort of loving and lovely family upbringing. But in a way, the sort of educative context around it slightly made my life a bit kind of peculiar as a teenager, in that I was I had a half scholarship and assisted place to get to at 11 to go to an independent school that was about 6 miles from where we lived in Romford. And you know, I mean, we had a very, very sort of loving sort of home and family life, me and my mum and dad and my brother and sister and I. But we had no money, you know. My mum didn't work. You know, she sort of was looking after us, and then she couldn't go back to work for one reason or another. And my dad was just a shoemaker. You know, he had learnt a little bit of kind of pin money, as he would say, helping out on a market stall and placing bets for someone. At Romford Dog Track at one time was something he did to bring in a little bit of kind of cash on the side. But it was a pretty sort of, you know, we relied a bit on, actually, I had two aunts who worked in Marks and Spencer's, and I can remember them really vividly every week coming round with bags of shopping. You know, I mean, we were sort of, you know, it was a bit like that. So, you know, and as I was a teenager, I sort of, my dad got me a job on the stall he worked on. And I kind of, like a lot of boys who lived in Romford, you know, it was one of the jobs that you could do as a teenager, which was work on a market stall, pack in and pack out the stall to earn a bit of pocket money. So sort of through my adolescence, there was sort of, you know, I would kind of, on a Wednesday, Friday and Saturday, because I went to school on a Saturday, it was an independent school, I would get up at 5:30 in the morning, go and unpack a market stall, you know, come rain or shine. At sort of 8:15, go in the stock trailer, change into this horrible grey tweed public school uniform, go to school, be a public schoolboy for a day, and then do the reverse in the evening. And I mean, it's a wonderful gift now for a writer to have seen such varied experiences.
Yeah.
But as a teenager, it was a bit of a strange experience sometimes. Yeah, so it was a bit weird. And, you know, Market Boy was a play, you know, that very much came out of, you know, those experiences of working in Romford Market. I got a job there when I was just turned 13, And I stayed there until the week before I went to university, when I just turned 19. So
when you went to university, had you got any kind of career in mind? You seem to have gone seamlessly into writing. Most people have to bum around and actually teach, perhaps, before they become writers. Have you been a full-time writer since?
I've been a full-time writer since leaving university. But no, when I went to university, I didn't... I wasn't at all, didn't know at all that I wanted to be a writer. You know, in fact, what happened was when I...
So you weren't writing in notebooks when you were 7 years old? And
No. I had a muck around one Christmas on a toy typewriter my sister got, but that's the only memory I've got of doing anything like that outside of what I did at school. No, the truth of it was that... You know, I could easily, at 16, have fallen in with a wrong crowd in Romford Market. And I just realised, a bit of sort of survival instinct in me realised that I had to be a bit more serious at school when I went back to do my A-levels. And when I went to the sixth form, I sort of took GCSE drama as a subsidiary subject, honestly, because I thought it might be a DOS, and because... My mate Simon didn't want to be the only bloke in a group that otherwise had just girls, and but of course, what happened was that I sort of absolutely loved it. And then the second key thing that happened was within like 2 weeks of being back at term, I'd suddenly had these two drama lessons, and there was a sixth form theatre trip to go and see Nick Heitner's production of King Lear at the Barbican, which had transferred from Stratford with John Wood as King Lear. And that was the first play I ever saw. I'd seen TV dramas.
That was the first...
What a way of entering
your experience of this.
But it's honestly true. The first play I ever saw was King Lear.
Were you studying it as a set text?
I was going to in the upper sixth. We were doing Much Ado in the lower sixth and King Lear in the upper sixth. And although we weren't going to do it for a year, because it was going to be one of our set texts, we went.
So did you go without knowing the story?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, I had an incredibly adolescent attitude to it, and I remember complaining bitterly to my friend that it was going to be boring Shakespeare. And just as the lights went down in the Barbican, my friend Angus, who I was sitting next to, said, someone gets their eyes pulled out halfway through. As a sort of a little sort of joke or incentive. And I was absolutely gobsmacked. I mean, when we came out of the interval, there were all these sort of sixth form girls that were sort of lusting after Linus Roach and Ralph Fiennes, who were both in it, playing Edgar and Edmund. And I was just quiet. I couldn't believe what I'd seen. Mm. And then we went back into the second half, and when John Wood came in carrying Alex Kingston's Cordelia, I could not believe it, because I just was expecting that it's over, because I didn't know the plot of the play. And I did actually have a few tears, and I remember, I mean, what a reversal in 4.5 hours, but I did actually was being a bit kind of cagey about Angus seeing that I was a bit sort of teary and a bit moved, but I was absolutely knocked out by it.
It's such a gift going to see it without knowing the story, isn't it?
It's wonderful. I mean, it's absolutely wonderful. And I it was a genuinely transformative moment, and it's why I sort of really believe fundamentally in the transformative nature of theatre, actually, when it's good, is because actually it did really change my life. And almost within that fortnight, I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to do something to do with drama. And at the time, you know, I mean, writing didn't seem anything that I might do at all, you know. So at the time, I just thought, I want to be a director. I want to make that happen. And for that time as a sixth former, and certainly for my first year at university, Sam Mendes was my hero a bit. I'd seen his productions of The Alchemist, of Troilus and Cressida, Richard III, and really memorable Richard III, actually, with Simon Russell Beale. And I just really desperately wanted to direct. But, I sort of... As I got into my second year at uni, I really felt strongly that, you know, I wasn't getting the time to direct plays because the course was busy. I couldn't really find plays that I wanted to direct that really sort of said lots of the things that were swilling around inside me. And that was the point at which I had to go at writing. So it was something, writing something that I arrived at rather than you know, and found that I could do. And once I found that I could do it and enjoyed it, realised that maybe I had a talent for it, then it's something that kind of I really embraced and have really enjoyed ever since. Mm.